We're going to study tonight from Romans chapter 4. You'll find that if you invite me for a revival meeting, we will not get very far into it until we get into the book of Romans. The book of Romans has played such a vital role in the history of Christianity. Come to Romans 4. We're going to begin with verse 13. And we're going to study a subject you probably don't hear very much about, the subject of faith. That's faith, F-A-I-T-H, faith. Oh, no. What more can be said about faith in the doctrine of the church? Well, maybe nothing, but I'm going to do some teaching on it. Now, let me read a few verses to get us into it, and then I'll stop and not go too far, and we'll begin to talk about this. For the promise, verse 13 of Romans 4, for the promise to Abraham or to his descendants that he would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, that he means if those who are only of the law are heirs, faith is made void and the promise is nullified. For the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, neither is there violation. For this reason, it is by faith that it might be in accordance with grace, in order that the promise may be certain to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Now, you probably didn't understand those verses, but you understood the words. I doubt you got the point. I know what it means, and I'm not sure I got the point. Because when you start in the middle and read like that, often it does not make sense. So let me give it some sense. The book of Romans, believe it or not, is not about some sophisticated subject, although it is the most profound theological treatise in the New Testament. The book of Romans is about something as simple as fellowship. The book of Romans is about the Jews in the church at Rome getting along with the Gentiles in the church at Rome and vice versa. That is what the book is about. There were in the church at Rome those who were Jews and those who were Gentiles. And they were not accepting each other. And the fellowship was broken. And Paul writes to them to tell them why they must accept one another. And he does not say, as you know or may not know, if you don't know, I'm going to teach you now, the basis of fellowship, biblical fellowship, has little or nothing to do with mutual congeniality. I grew up thinking that fellowship and supper were the same word. The only time I ever heard the word fellowship, when I was a little boy in the church, we were getting ready to eat. Fellowship, supper. Just, even now, when I hear the word fellowship, I start to salivate. But fellowship is not, by the way, me liking you and you liking me. The biblical concept of fellowship is that we belong to each other whether we like each other or not. I like that. I stayed 13 years in the church preaching that. If you don't like me or not, I'm yours. And they kept me. Now, the message of the book of Romans is that there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The theme word of the book of Romans is the word all. There is no difference between Jew and Greek, and he answers the substance of the book of Romans is Paul systematically answering the reasons given both by Jews and by Gentiles, but primarily by Jews, why they are not accepting the other party. And I wish I had time to go into that, but I do not. Let me tell you where we are in Romans 4 to come to our text. The main point, and I'm not going to preach from the main point of this part of Romans chapter 4 tonight, I'm going to preach from a secondary point. The main point of Romans 4 is this. You see, the Jews in the church at Rome were saying, well, now, you Gentile Christians aren't the same kind of Christians that we are. Why? Well, you came late. You just got started in this covenant business. We are children of Abraham. That makes us a different kind of Christian than you are, a better Christian. And Paul says something that Jesus, makes a point that Jesus made several times during his public ministry, and it turned the Jews against him. One of the things that turned the Jews against him. He says this, that those who had Abraham's flesh are not his children, nor were they ever his children in the mind of God. Only a man with Abraham's faith is his child. And if a man had Abraham's faith, he was a child of Abraham, no matter what his flesh was. So he's saying to the Jewish Christians, you can come down off your high and mighty, because the Gentiles who have accepted the gospel are walking by faith, just as you are, and if they have faith in the Messiah, they are Abraham's children just as much as you are. There is no distinction, therefore you can accept one another. He brings this to focus in the last statement which we read in verse 16. Abraham, who is the father of us, who? All. The theme word in the book of Romans, all. Now that he has made that point, he cannot seem to get stopped. And the reason that the book of Romans is such a difficult book to understand, and it is difficult, is because Paul not only, he must have had a lot of time that day when he wrote this or dictated it. Because when he gets their theology straightened out on many points, he does not do it briefly nor superficially. He does it profoundly. That is, he goes down deep, stays down long, comes up wet. He just develops it. And he develops this here. He has introduced the theme, the teaching. Are you with me now? I keep saying, I'm used to teaching students who are half dead, 7:30 in the morning, so I have to work on both sides of this, so you'll forgive me. It's a habit I've developed. He has made his theological point that the Jews are not better than the Gentiles because it was faith that made them children of Abraham, not flesh. And it's always been that way. Then he goes on to develop this theme that Abraham is the father of the Christian faith, that is, Abraham's faith is the model or prototype of the Christian faith. Therefore, he is not only the father of our faith in the fact that we have faith in Christ. Now hear me, Christian. Not only the father of our faith in the fact that we do believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah, but his kind of faith is the model for what our kind of faith is to be. Now, Abraham as the father or model or prototype of the Christian faith is developed in three texts in the New Testament, Romans chapter 4, Hebrews chapter 11, and James chapter 2, and in each case, a different point is being made. I've already discussed the point being made in Romans 4. In Hebrews 11, he is writing to Jewish Christians who have gone through one generation and had a tough time doing it, surviving it. They are being wooed back by their fellow countrymen and their family back into the law of Moses, being called upon to abandon the gospel and go back to Moses. And they were saying, you have left Abraham. Come back to Abraham. And he writes to these Jewish Christians saying, if you went to Abraham, he'd say, don't come back to me because you are where I look forward to being. You understand? That Abraham looked forward, and if you're going to look back, you can't look back in his name, because you have this Abraham. In Hebrews 11, he makes this point. Abraham looked for a city that hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He longed for this city, and you're in the city. What is the city? It's the New Jerusalem, the church of the living God. Therefore, if you leave the church and go back to Moses, you have left the city that Abraham longed for. So if you're going to do that, don't do it in Abraham's name. That's Hebrews 11. In James 2, where he makes the great statement, faith without works is what? Dead. He again offers Abraham as the pattern or the model or the prototype of the Christian faith. But his point there is that certain Christians were accepting the many Jews accepted it, dualism of the first century that said faith consists in what you think, in the intangibles, in what you believe. It's enough to believe right. And he's saying it's not enough to think right or believe right. You must do right. The man does not do right, it's sin. You say to your brother, be fed, and if you don't give him anything to eat, then you are not operating by faith. And he uses Abraham as the example. Now, so we have those three texts. The two events in Abraham's life which come into focus in the New Testament, and I'm doing some summary and paraphrasing because of time. The two events in Abraham's life, and you know this as well as I do, which single him out as the man of faith and qualifies his faith to be the prototype of our faith is, number one, when he believed God when God said he would have a son and through whom he would have many descendants when he was too old to do that, and Sarah was too old. And secondly, when this boy was a teenager, probably about 16 years old, He was told to offer this son on the altar to put him to death before he had descendants. And Abraham did that. It says in Hebrews 11, Abraham offered Isaac. As a matter of fact, he did not offer Isaac, but he was going to. It was an accomplished fact in his mind. Then we know that story, and I don't have to tell that. Now, so those three texts with about Abraham being the father of our faith and those two events in the life of Abraham. Now, let me sort of summarize with special attention being given to Romans 4. Let me reach out in paraphrase and in reference to these other two texts and bring the whole teaching together in the next few minutes and help us to understand why and exactly how and in what specifics Abraham's faith is the model for our faith so that we might bring our faith up to Abraham's standard if that's what we need to do. First of all, I would discuss the foundation of Abraham's faith. Upon what was his faith built? Well, let's look at the text, verse 17. As it is written, the father of many nations I have made you, and here he includes this, among those nations of the Gentiles and the church, in the sight of him whom he believed, that is, Abraham believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. Now, I said I was going to talk about the foundation. I misspoke that. I mean, I want to speak secondly about the foundation. We wouldn't understand what I was talking about. Let me talk about the content of his faith. Then we'll talk about the foundation. What was the content of his faith? What did Abraham believe that other people who believed in God did not believe that made their faith insufficient, which made his faith sufficient? It says, who gives life to the dead. Abraham did not simply believe in a supreme being. I mean, you couldn't shake a bush in those days without somebody falling out who believed in a supreme being. You don't have to go very far today, even in our secularized society, to find somebody who believes in God. That is an easy thing to do. It's hard not to. But Abraham didn't just believe in God. He believed, hear me, he believed that his God was the God and the only God who gives life to the dead, who takes death and out of death brings life. Now note the language in Romans 4, verse 18. In hope against hope, he believed in order that he might become the father of many nations. That's the basic theme in Romans 4. According to that which had been spoken, so shall your descendants be. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. Yet with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God, being fully assured that what he had promised, he was also able to perform. Now note the language that the apostle uses. It says, Abraham looked at himself, and he looked at his wife. And he said to himself, about himself, when it comes to having children, I'm dead. Note the word, it's the word death that's used. He didn't say I'm too old. Good. He said, verse 19, now as good as what? Dead. Neither the what? Deadness of Sarah's womb. He looked at his wife, and he said, as far as having a baby, a child, she is as good as dead. Her womb is dead. Yet, even though his body was dead, as far as its ability to conceive a child, Sarah's womb was dead in that it was past the time when it could carry a child, yet he did not waver in unbelief. He believed that God would bring a living child out of his dead body and Sarah's dead womb. He believed that. Now we go on down to, I'm going to skip down, you'll see why later. Down to verse 23. Now, not for his sake only was it written that it was reckoned to him, but for our sake. You see, Abraham's faith is the pattern of our faith. But for our sake also, to whom it will be reckoned, as those who believe in him who raised Jesus our Lord from the what? Dead. You see, Abraham's faith is the pattern for our faith in this respect because the pivotal factor in his faith, the element in his faith, that particular which he believed, which others did not believe, was that his God was not only God, but his God could bring life from death. And that is the pivotal character, point, content of the Christian faith. That is, the foundational point in the Christian faith is that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, never to die again. If we do not believe that, we are not Christians. There is no such thing as a Christian faith that does not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. If it does not include that, it may sit in a church three times a week. It is not Christian. It is not acceptable to God. If we do not believe that God raised Jesus from the dead, it matters not what else we believe. Now, I made that point clear. He believed God brought life from death. We believe God brings life from death. And in particular, he raised Jesus from the dead. And by extension, someday he shall raise us from the dead, because the resurrection of Jesus is the foundation and guarantee of our resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15, many other texts. Now, you see, Abraham's faith had to have a certain content before it would be acceptable to God. Our faith has to have content. There's no... The modern secular mind attributes virtue to the simple fact of believing. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you believe. That simply is not true. Never has been true. Could not be true. That's not logical. It doesn't make any sense. And so it is not simply believing, but what we believe. Okay, if I haven't made that point, I never will, so I'm going to move on. Upon what did he build this faith? The content of his faith, life from death. Now, before I leave that, let me point out, let me just reach over into Hebrews 11, that it says, the Hebrew writer explains, Paul explains, why Abraham could bring himself to kill the son through whom he believed he was going to have countless descendants. And he knew as well as I know that dead children do not produce grandchildren. And it says he did it, without taking time to flip over to Hebrews 11 and read it, he did it because he was convinced that God was going to raise him from the dead. It was no great thing. He had done it before. He's going to do it again. That was logical, wasn't it? God brought this boy, and this boy is life from death. He has promised me that through this son, through Isaac, I'm going to have descendants. He tells me to kill Isaac. He's going to have to bring him from the dead to keep his promise. I believe he can do it. And he raised the knife. And again, to repeat myself, in the language of Hebrews 11, he offered Isaac. You see, it's one thing to believe that God could do it. Well, I'll come back to that later. Now, what was the foundation of this faith? Where did Abraham get the idea that his God could bring life from death? Well, we go back to verse 17. It says this. He believed God, who gives life to the dead. And look at this language. And calls into being that which does not exist. He believed Genesis 1:1. He calls into being that which does not exist. Abraham's faith was a very reasonable faith. One of the grandest lies, by grand in its effect, in a deadly way, one of the most successful lies, let me use that word, that Satan has ever told the church is that the opposite of faith is reason. Listen. Faith and reason are never in contradiction. The Bible doesn't say that. Faith is not the opposite of reason. Faith is simply reason grown courageous. You see, many things we believe go beyond our information, but they do not go against our reason. I want you to write that down. It is one thing to say, for instance, such doctrines as the Trinity, which we believe but cannot fully understand. Miracles, which we believe, but we cannot fully understand. But they do not contradict the law of cause and effect. Many things, many elements in our faith touch things which go beyond our information, but they do not go against our reason. Now, Abraham believed that his God was the God of Genesis 1:1. His was the God who brings into being that which does not exist. Something from nothing. You see, here's how Abraham thought, if I understand this correctly. When God said to him, you're going to have a baby, you and Sarah, a little boy. Buy the crib, get the car seat, and sign up for the diaper service. There's a baby coming. And Abraham, too old. But he looked around. I mean, here's how he thought. Well, you know, the God who told me this is the God who produced life from nothing. If he did it once, I figure he can do it again. You got that? If he did it once, he can do it again. If he can bring a whole universe, a whole living universe, if he can bring into being that which does not exist, It's no great trick for him to give me a live baby from a dead womb. Now, is that logical? That is perfectly logical. You see, the creation was the foundation of his faith. I was here a couple, 3 years ago, and I gave a weekend lectureship on the theory of evolution. I wish I had several hours this week to update you on the exciting material that has come to light since then, where the leaders in the scientific community are now have utterly dismissed much of the nonsense that appears in the textbooks, and much of what's in the textbooks was been dismissed 30 or 40 years ago anyway. Wish I could take time to show you such books as Robert Jastrow's God and the Astronomers, who is, Jastrow is the founder and director of the Goddard Institute of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the Florida, in which he points out that the mathematics of Einstein and the observations of Hubble and others make it unquestionable, and thousands of the world's astrophysicists and scientists and biologists are joining him in this, and they're saying, it's beyond question now, the universe had a beginning. Anybody that says the universe did not have a beginning, that it's always been here, has simply not done his homework. He would be like a doctor who would treat cancer with leeches. He's out of date. He's old hat, still in the textbooks. But in fact, it is the word they are using. You know what the word that some of the world's leading scientists are using from the idea that the world just happened into existence or that it's always been here? The word they are using is the word superstition. They used to use that against us. Superstitious nonsense. We know the universe had a beginning. Then when we talk about the transition from chemistry to life, prebiotic evolution, lightning striking the primordial soup, you know that stuff. Utter nonsense. I was telling a family this afternoon that, for instance, I'll give an example, Robert Shapiro, the professor of chemistry at the New York University recently published a book called Origins, in which he calls that textbook explanation biomythology. Just finished a very forceful study that's having impact all across the scientific community by three authors, Bradley, Olson, and Thaxton, on the it's about the reassessment of the theories of origins. And these men have become creationists. They simply said that explanation is absurd. It has always been absurd. And the more we look at it, the more absurd it gets. And let's just be honest and realize that not only did the universe, listen to me, not only did the universe have a beginning, not only did life have a definite beginning, it had an intelligent beginning. It had a planned beginning. There must be a God. Well, you see, that's the direction. And those who, scientific atheists, if there ever was such a thing, belong in the dark ages. They're behind the times. They're out of it. They are fossils. You see, if we hang on to the gospel and wait long enough, they'll come back around to us. Something always brings them around to us. AIDS, all kinds of things. If we just hang on, the wisdom of the Christian position will become apparent. Just like, you notice, I read a study, this is a question, I read a study, very serious study by a sociologist who just discovered last year that abstinence works. You can prevent pregnancies by abstinence.
I already knew that.
Do you notice that the world is rejoicing? They discovered a new secret called say no. Have you noticed that we who for 30 years were behind the times are now ahead? Well, we're ahead on this too. And Abraham was ahead. Why? Abraham believed in life from death because his God was the God who brought into being something from nothing. A living world was the product of the intelligent acts of his God. Therefore, a living child was no great thing. The content of his faith, life from death. The foundation of his faith, he did it once, he'll do it again. What was the character of his faith? Now we get down to the nitty-gritty and the reason I'm preaching this message. The character of his faith, and here we go over into James chapter 2 and Hebrews 11. Romans 4 only mentions the promise of the birth of Isaac. James 2 and Hebrews 11 mention the offering of Isaac. But the theme is the same. The point they're making, as I've already explained, which are different. And James explains that Abraham's faith was not simply his believing that God could bring back Isaac from the dead. Abraham's faith was his offering of Isaac. Faith without works is dead. That is, if Abraham had simply affirmed, if he had been a good modern belief-only Protestant, he would have said, faith has nothing to do with the physical act. You cannot bring about a spiritual end with the physical act. Have you ever heard that? Do you ever notice anytime anybody wants to put baptism down, they say, you cannot bring about a spiritual result with the physical act. That's utter nonsense. I point to the cross, which is a very physical act, which brought about a very physical, very spiritual end. And Abraham's faith, Abraham not being a belief-only fellow, he knew that he could stand there on the mountains of Moriah with that boy on the altar from then until the cows came home and say, you know, I believe God can do it, but there was no faith until he offered Isaac. You got that? There was no faith until he offered Isaac. If he hadn't offered Isaac, his faith would have been dead. Now, let me teach this point, take a shortcut by doing it this way, by asking a question. My question is this. Suppose Abraham had been wrong. Suppose Abraham had taken that knife and plunged it into the heart of Isaac, and Isaac died, and he stayed dead, and Abraham had to strap the boy's body to the animal that carried the wood up the mountain and take him home to his mother. Would Abraham have come down through history as the model of anything good, let alone faith? No. Abraham, if his name had been remembered at all, would have been written off as one more Canaanite who killed his kids. You got that? One more Canaanite who killed the babies and the babies stayed dead. My point is this. Abraham's faith required him to put on that altar something he could not afford to lose if he had been wrong. And I suggest to you tonight that an Abrahamic faith requires that somewhere along the line, something be put on the altar that we cannot afford to lose if we're wrong. You see, Abraham's faith was a faith that trusted. Trusted with something that was precious to him. Not only was Isaac his son, he was the son of the promise. There's a sentiment going around, often expressed like this. You know, the Christian life is such a grand life, such a good idea, such a beautiful way to live, that even if it's not true, even if I come to the end of my life and find out that Christianity is false, that Jesus is dead after all, and the whole thing has been a horrible mistake, it's been a good way to live anyway. Ever heard that? Billy Sunday had a song evangelist, Gypsy Smith, who sang a song, I think he wrote it, I'm not sure, called If I'm Dreaming, Let Me Dream On. This whole Christian life is just a dream. It's a good dream. Just let me dream on. Now, you may believe that. It's a matter of opinion and taste. I don't believe it a bit. I don't buy it. Christianity is not true. Count me out. It's not worth it. Let me read some verses written by the author of the book of Romans, Paul, to a very troublesome church in Corinth, 2 Corinthians 11. They were saying that Paul's not an apostle, doesn't belong, Paul shouldn't be counted with the other apostles, and he's defending himself. He says this, verse 22, are they Hebrews, that is, they apostles? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I'm more so. Talk about being an apostle. In far more labors, no apostles worked any harder than I have, far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death, 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes, 3 times I was beaten with rods, 1 I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked, 1 night and 1 day I spent in the deep, been on frequent journeys, dangers in the rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers from the city, dangers from the wilderness, dangers on the sea, and dangers among false brothers. I've been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights and hunger and thirst, often been without food and cold and exposure. And apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern from all the churches. But if I find out it's all false, it's been a good life anyway. If I'm dreaming, let me dream on. Just such a nice life. If I come to the end of my life and find out that Christianity is a farce, I'm glad I was a Christian. I don't think he would have said that at all. I think he would have said, I've been the biggest fool the world has ever known. I've been what Abraham would have been if he had killed Isaac. And his God, as a matter of fact, was not the God who brought life from the dead and kept his promises. What I'm saying is this, and I hope I say it clearly, and I want to say it kindly and lovingly, that if you think that Christianity is a nice way to live, even if it's not true, it may be because your Christianity has never really cost you anything. It may be you've never killed Isaac. And I don't know that. I'm not your judge. I'm your teacher. They say that, and I understand this is true. I don't know if it's true. I've read this. That a professional gambler is distinguished from an amateur gambler, and that the professional gambler never puts anything on the table he can't walk away from. He never gambles with his rent money and his food money. He keeps that in a separate pocket. Therefore, he can walk away from anything that's on the table. And since the reason they do that, I read, was that if they put money on the table they can't afford to lose, then they get emotional. They get wrapped up in it. Their heart starts to beat fast. They get scared. Their judgment suffers, and they lose. One of the secrets to winning by professional gamblers is to make sure that nothing is on the table that they can't walk away from. They remain objective, cool, and they win more often. Now, whether that's true or not, that may be good advice for a gambler, but the Christian has no business in that kind of thing. One of the problems that we in the leadership in the church have is trying to get people and trying to get ourselves to develop some passion, to really care, to get emotionally involved. You see, and I've been in the ministry a long time, and I say this as a point of observation, and if I sound judgmatic, you're going to have to forgive me. But I see many Christians who never really cared about Christianity, drain the energies of the church trying to keep them faithful, no passion, because they never killed Isaac. They never put anything on the table they couldn't walk away from. They committed so little to the Christian faith that if they found out it was wrong, that it was false at the end of their life, they wouldn't have lost anything. You see, the Christian life, in its essence, is that kind of life. You see, apart from particular acts of faith, you understand, don't you, that we're betting our lives that Jesus is alive. See, tonight while we're holding this service up and down this road, there are people who are driving by, and they look over and see the lights on in this building, and they're thinking, those people are a bunch of fools. And if Jesus is still dead, they're right. Right? They're right. We're betting our lives that Jesus is alive. What I'm saying is this, Christian, let's live our lives in such a way that in some way, and what this is for you, it is not mine to say. But let's have the kind of faith that is Abrahamic. Let's have the kind of faith that in some way, at some time, in some sense at least, in a very real sense, is a killing of Isaac, where we put something on the altar as a way of life, as a systematic way of life, that we can't afford to lose if we're wrong. The content of Abraham's faith, life from death. The foundation of his faith, the creation. The character of his faith, he killed Isaac. And what was the result of it? It says, and this is the last thing I have to say tonight, Verse 22. Therefore, because Abraham acted by faith, this kind of faith, therefore also it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Now this is repeated in the book of James. That kind of faith is reckoned as righteousness. Now, not for his sake only was it written that it was reckoned to him, but for our sake also, to whom it will be reckoned, as those who believe in him who raised Jesus our Lord from the dead. You get that? It is at this point where Abraham's faith, that kind of faith, sets Christianity apart from the false religions in the world. I declare to you tonight something which I know you already believe. I affirm for us all, not only that Christianity is true, but Christianity is true in such a way that it makes all other religions false. That Jesus is not a way to God. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to God but by Him. And it is at this point that Christianity becomes different, because all of the false religions, the ancient false religions of the world, would look at Abraham's faith and say, "What a righteous man! If any man earned salvation, he did." But the Bible does not say that the act of believing in a life-giving God and the act of offering Isaac, that made Abraham righteous. It does not say that was Abraham's righteousness. It says it was his faith. God reckoned to him his righteousness. You see, God does not demand perfection. It's a good thing. We've got no perfection to give. God does not demand it. He does not require it. He imputes it. What he does require is faith. We are saved by faith. But Abraham's kind of faith, because Abraham had that kind of faith, it was reckoned to him. It was accounted. That is, a transaction took place in the mind of God. And that's where salvation takes place. Salvation takes place not in the heart of man, but the mind of God. Christ does not come in here and save us because we are not lost in here. Christ offers his blood to the Father because it is in the mind of God that we are lost. And God reckoned. He made a transaction. He counted Abraham as being righteous and therefore a candidate for eternal fellowship with an absolutely righteous God. But God reckoned that. He had to reckon it because Abraham was still a sinner. Was he not? You see, Abraham did not save himself. All the false religions in the world would have had Abraham saving himself by that act. But he didn't. Hear me. We are saved by faith through grace, not of works, lest any man should boast. We are saved by imputed righteousness, not personal righteousness. And God grants that. He imputes that to us. He counts it to us. He reckons it to us. When? When we have the kind of faith that takes Isaac to Moriah and offers him. When we have the kind of faith that steps out and acts. Faith without works is dead. You see, when we, week by week from this pulpit, challenge those who are not Christians to physically rise from where they are and in repentance and belief, walk down this physical aisle and confess that faith, and to submit themselves to a physical act, being baptized into Christ for the remission of sins, that is salvation by faith. A faith that acts. Faith in the New Testament is not simply an intellectual concept. Faith in the New Testament is a dynamic thing. It's a faith that puts it on the altar. Now, if you're not a Christian tonight, now's the time to do some thinking. In just a moment, we're going to sing our invitation hymn. And we want you to obey the gospel if you're not a Christian. Here's what we mean by that. I've explained it basically just now. But I want to say one more thing, then we're going to sing. When you come and give your life to Christ, it has to be just that. You see, becoming a Christian is not taking out a life insurance policy. It's not hedging your bets. It's not saying, "I'm going to buy into a franchise because it might be true." killing Isaac. You got that? It's one thing to put your name on a church roll. It's something else to kill Isaac. It's something else to come to Jesus saying and meaning, I'm going to give to you, Lord, my life, and I'm going to give you my life in such a way that I'm going to put on the altar that which I cannot afford to lose. And if I'm wrong, I'm a fool. I'll be very honest with you, and I hope you don't think this is boasting. I don't mean it that way. And I don't go into a lot for personal testimonies, but I'm going to give you a personal testimony. One of my goals in life, very frankly, is to live my life in such a way that if Christianity is wrong, I want to be left as one of the world's greatest fools. If it's wrong, I want to be wrong with it. Wrong all the way. Because if I believe it, if I don't take that attitude, I can't be right with it. And if you'll have the kind of faith that Abraham had, God will count that as perfect righteousness. You'll be a Christian. You'll be saved. That's as clear as I know how to make it. Why don't you respond while we stand and while we sing?